once more into the breach, dear friend.
Else close the wall up with our English dead.
And here we are, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, with another exciting second hour of The Personal Wealth Coach on this Saturday, May 20th, 2017. 2017, the year of our Lord, 2017, in the 21st century.
Well, that's, some people call it CE, which is current era, as opposed to some other era, which also happens to coincide with
BCE.
A historic birth of someone.
Plus or minus 5 years. Like,
right. Yeah. Yeah.
This is the CE and BCE, and then there's AD and BC.
And it's kind of, it's a wave of the... you know, the wrist, a little limp-wristed wave to say, oh, we're not talking Christianity here. It's a current era represented by what start date? Well, the era start date.
Yeah.
What happened then? Well, the era started. Right.
Yes, the current era. Well, you know, I mean, whatever turns people on. So what else is new in the big wide world? IBM. You know what IBM did?
Yes.
IBM.
One of the great pioneers of working from home.
Yes, and the number one seller of business software that allows people to work remotely from home. And they, by the way, sell it, advertise it, say it has huge productivity gains.
Increases productivity. Efficiency goes up.
They've just told their employees, guess what? You're not working from home anymore. You can either come into a regional office or you can go do something else for a living.
They didn't say it to all their employees.
But many, including the division that sells their work-from-home product, had to move.
They just said it to their most profitable divisions.
Oh, they're probably going to sell the rest of them.
It's really, really interesting here. And this is where we can start putting some pieces together. IBM's been 18 quarters now of loss. Their revenues are lower or losing money. They're not necessarily losing money every one of those quarters, but they're making less revenue than they were the quarter before,
right?
Or the year before for that quarter. Their most profitable divisions, Watson, Design, those are big ones. Those are really big for IBM. Without those, they would be in a lot more trouble. It's basically their AI, their new product development. If you think about what would possibly save IBM, these are the ones. And it includes, as you said, the place that writes the software for working remotely. And have now been said, you can't work remotely anymore. And there's a huge danger there. We mentioned this at the end of last hour. We're at full employment. We've been at full employment in the categories for those employees for about 5 years. People are poaching each other's employees at high speed. If you're working for the Watson division of IBM, you've got something on your resume that will allow you to get a big pay raise almost anywhere. And they're removing one of the benefits. Probably not the best idea in the world, IBM.
I think Warren Buffett should be listened to very carefully. And one of the things he said at his meeting, his annual meeting, is that he made a mistake. He invested in IBM.
Yeah.
So I think
they've got some really, really smart people there. They've got some programs that are showing some great, amazing developments. But if in this environment where good employees are a hot commodity, they are easily traded. It's like being in a baseball team. If you've got the best performer, you don't say, I'm giving you a pay cut. You've got to do things that we didn't require you to do before.
IBM started and made its first mistake a long time ago, big mistake that set the course when they said they hired Bill Gates to write a disk operating system for a personal computer, and they decided not to keep the disk operating system because they thought there was no future for small computing devices.
Except here, this is important. I think that was one of the greatest things for the benefit to their country and company long term, because it kept them in business. The IBM and then the PC, the IBM clones came out in great number, but for a long time, IBM was the standard for those computers. Until they sold it to China, that computer division, which you know, it's
well, but the point is
they made a lot of bad decisions there.
They really have stuck to this belief system that big iron, you know, big mainframe computers are the future. And they don't
they've
seem
been
to
saying
quite,
that for a long time, and that's what Watson is. Yeah.
They don't seem to quite get the fact that it's not working that way. The things are going to smaller and smaller and smaller. And
right. This is key, and this will help people. If you think back to sci-fi movies, back in the 80s, Demolition Man's a good idea for this one. You've got self-driving cars in Demolition Man. But there's some great vast computer sitting somewhere off camera that's controlling all the vehicles. And when you take over manually, it's got to figure out what you're doing and say, so there's alarms that go off. So Sylvester Stallone doesn't trust the computer to drive. He takes over. It ends in a crash, by the way, just as a side note. That does end in a massive crash, which most high-speed car chases in the 90s movies, they have to end in a car crash. That's the way things go. The computer wouldn't have allowed that. Sylvester Stallone picked up the controls and thus made the movie successful by having a good crash in it.
That and Taco Bell.
And Taco Bell won the restaurant wars. The concept there is that...
Franchise wars.
That's what... And the concept there, and it's something that's held throughout most of our history, is that some large entity will take over each area. That's kind of a socialist mentality. It's not the way things work. What's happened is that self-driving cars have lots of computers inside them, and they may communicate with other computers, but there's not an overreaching one big computer, because if that thing went down, the whole system would break. If Tesla's cars were all controlled by one computer somewhere, and that computer had any kind of glitch, or you had a broadband access problem, then you're in trouble. So what we're seeing is that IBM's moving towards this large AI concept with big, big computers. While our computers are getting smaller and smaller and more powerful, and this is an example of, you know, LEDs, light-emitting diodes.
Yes. I've met several in my
Yes.
life.
Those things that we put in our light bulbs and so on that actually are very cost-efficient and so on. For a long time, the light-emitting diode was this little light, and it had a little limiter. I'm not going to get into any kind of technical things. To lower the voltage going into the LED so that it could light up at its brightest point and so on. Well, somewhere there was some kind of computer chip that was way too big to put on the LED to control when it turns on, when it turns off, all that good stuff. They're now putting the processor chips, the little processor chips, are so much smaller than the LED that they have to use tiny gold wires that you can't solder them. They use gold because when there's no oxygen and you touch gold together, it automatically combines in a soldering without heat. So they have to use gold to solder on these tiny little LEDs. They're using so little gold that it doesn't cause the price to come up at all. In fact, the price goes down so that all of that stuff is on the LED now. There's a little computer in a light bulb. And if you've got lots of LEDs in your light bulb, there's lots of computers in there, and that's the future. The computers are going to keep getting smaller and smaller and smaller so that every fiber of our clothes and maybe every section of that fiber will have a processor on it eventually, not some huge Watson-esque machine sitting and looking over everything. It's going to be networks of tiny computers, and IBM chose the wrong path. They still probably have a long time of profitability even with the wrong path being chosen, but they're not showing a great deal of forethought.
Speaking of manufacturing and that type of thing, I just want to throw something out there that I noticed that is an indication of why the market recovered this week and why the stock market is doing relatively well despite the noise coming out of Washington. I do really seriously mean despite, because that is damaging. The John Deere, you know, you see the local John Deere dealership. So we can kind of relate to Deere. It's called Deere and Company.
This isn't Deere John. Those are letters that nobody this wants to get. This is John Deere.
This is a member of the New York Stock Exchange. Symbol is DE, which should tell you a lot. Two-letter symbols are pretty rare.
Yeah, that means they've been around a long
time. Their stock jumped significantly this week, over 7%.
A Deere jumped?
And it did so because of a huge and relatively unexpected increase in their revenue and their profits. And it didn't come from selling tractors in the United States.
No.
It came from selling tractors in South America, selling equipment in South America, where there is – I mean, we just don't think too much about the fact that Argentina is having an economic rebound. We don't think about the fact that
– Brazil is getting close to passing us in corn production.
So what we have – is a lot of the plus in the U.S. stock market that we've seen since November is oddly, this is one of those strange weirdnesses that the market routinely does. A lot of that is because the European market has been growing faster than the United States market. The South American market has been growing faster than the U.S. market for the last year. And as a result of these things, we are selling, our exports are up. We are selling a lot more stuff, and in some cases, it doesn't even show up as exports because if John Deere, for example, were manufacturing, and they do, if they were manufacturing tractors in Mexico, but selling them to South America, but retaining the profits in the, but the profits are coming to the stock, which is a U.S. stock.
But then the taxes are being paid in Mexico and not being brought back to the United States to pay exorbitant corporate taxes.
So what we have going on in the stock market, our stock market is no longer as tied to the U.S. economy as it once was because of globalization, which kind of brings us, there's a couple of big subjects that I would like us to talk about. One is the issues of full employment, which is pretty much where we are. And the other is the fact that there was an announcement this week that the United States officially is going to renegotiate NAFTA. And President Trump has said if he doesn't like the way negotiations go, he'll pull us out of it. That rise that we had this week in the market was largely because of NAFTA.
The rise to take us out of the Trump slump, where bad news came out about Trump, the market dropped. Good news came out about international companies based in the United States, earnings up.
And for instance, John Deere makes a lot of the parts that go into those tractors that are made in Mexico in the United States.
Which means people here get paid for that.
Right. If we were to kill NAFTA, that would go away.
We would just make them elsewhere, because what happens with NAFTA, if it's very similar, we don't have the same kind of trade deal with Japan as we have with Mexico or Canada. Japan has a large corporation, Toyota, and Toyota is obviously a Japanese company. It listed itself in the New York Stock Exchange. Now the majority ownership of this Japanese company is an American ownership. The majority ownership in Toyota is America. That's weird. The cars that are sold in the United States from Toyota are majority made in the United States. So is Japan a Japanese company or an American company?
You just said, is Japan a Japanese company?
Yeah, or an American company.
Is Japan a Japanese company?
Oh, yeah, Toyota. Is Japan a Japanese company? I guess not. My tang tangled.
Just wanted to get you straight on that, okay?
Is Toyota a Japanese company, or is it an American company, or is it something else? And when...
It's a global company.
What happened there? There's two big pieces that happened there. When we talk about the corporate tax rate being so high in the United States, for a long time, it was not the highest in the developed world, and we didn't raise it to get it there.
We just didn't lower it.
We didn't lower it when Japan lowered theirs. Toyota left Japan because its shareholders recognized that if they manufactured all their cars in Japan and they took all their profits in Japan, they were going to pay a much higher tax rate than if they manufactured in Germany or in the United States. And in the process of going to the United States, they lost ownership. The majority ownership is no longer Japanese. So in having a corporate tax rate too high, And in low and making the tariffs, the trade deal where we charge if you import or export back and forth with Japan, Japan had these exorbitant import taxes where if you sent anything to Japan, it had to go through this taxation system, which is part of the reason why the big car companies didn't take off in Japan from the United States. We don't like that still. It made Toyota leave Japan.
Very frankly, every economist I have read and the few I've had the chance to speak to agree on something, and that is if we scrap NAFTA, we have put ourselves in the position of shrinking the United States economy and causing fewer jobs to be here.
What it would do directly is Facebook would become multiple companies. Google would become even more multiple companies. All of the Apple would have to become multiple companies. Anytime we start looking at the, because when in the process of doing the NAFTA abolition, we're also talking about border adjustment tax, which in any other term, any other point in history, is just called a tariff. Let's not get a new name for the same thing. It's like calling chocolate beans the cocoa beans. It's not cocoa. It's cocoa. Well, spelled the same way. Yes, but we're pronouncing it this way now. It's much fancier. Well, let's not call it a border adjustment tax either. It's not cocoa. It's cocoa. It's a tariff. And if we set up tariffs to help pay for things when we're getting rid of free trade, what we do is we cause companies that are profitable and that bring at least some of their profits back to the United States to stop bringing their profits back to the United States and to stop manufacturing in the United States.
There's a really fascinating thing that the trade representative said when he made the announcement officially that we're going to renegotiate NAFTA. He stated some changes that the Trump administration wants made in NAFTA. Almost all of those changes had already been negotiated as part of the Trans-Pacific Partnership.
Right.
Mexico was part of that treaty.
And that would have been
happened. That would have already happened.
It would have already been signed.
And we would already have made the changes that he wants to make.
There's a problem there.
We really need to be very careful about this. If in fact we were to suddenly chop NAFTA, it would be extremely damaging to almost every sector of the economy.
This is something we have to make this as clear as we possibly can. There are some areas that NAFTA damaged the U.S. economy.
Mm-hmm. But they're not going to recover.
No, those are areas that were already being damaged. The avocado sales in the United States are not what they used to be, but it wasn't a big chunk of our system. However, car manufacturing in the United States, electronics manufacturing, book printing, you go down the list of industries that were positively affected by NAFTA, and you'll find that the vast majority of the gains associated with free trade were in the United States. And we can point at Mexican trucks driving on American highways and go, well, look at that. That means Mexico's truck drivers have benefited from this. And yes, they have. This is one of those invisible hand things where it raised the well-being of all the countries involved because we were able to do profitable trades in all directions. But the vast majority, and by vast, I mean There's no comparison. The vast majority of the gains for NAFTA have been in the United States, the American workers all the way up to the business owners. We've lost jobs to NAFTA, no doubt. We gained a lot more, no doubt. These are numbers that anyone can look up. Most people don't. They'd rather read a headline about avocado farmers here, which, by the way, most avocado farms in the United States had to be done in greenhouses.
Well, in California, they had water.
When they had the water for it, yeah.
But let me take that and relate it to another major issue right now, and that is the fact that we're at full employment. We are effectively – we've reached the point, and it was announced this week, no big headlines. It's just you had to look for the numbers. We now have more job openings in the United States than we have people who are actively looking for work. And I want to say that again. We now have more job openings in the United States.
People saying, help wanted, please, we need to hire someone.
And if you don't believe that, it doesn't take a high level of skill. Well, it does, but you have to. The companies will train you. It doesn't take a lot of education to drive an 18-wheeler. It does take a level of skill, and there are lots of schools that will train, and in many cases, the companies that hire you will train you to drive an 18-wheeler if you're willing to learn to drive an 18-wheeler. And yet, if you drive down the highway, you'll notice that probably a majority, I haven't done a formal survey of this, of 18-wheelers have a sign on the back saying we'd like to hire some more drivers, but they're not getting the drivers. And those drivers are not poorly paid.
No, they're well compensated, means that when you can't find people to fill well-compensated jobs, the robots are coming.
But the robots are coming, but they're not here yet. But this is the point.
That means if you're a truck driver now, make bank while you can. Hay is perfect right now. Don't expect it to stay this way into the winter.
The point that I want to make here is that the push to create more jobs in the United States, more job openings in the United States, is economists look at that and say, huh? And they say that because we're out of people to hire. And you say, well, there are places in the United States where unemployment is still high. Sure.
That's true.
And that's not going to change. If we get rid of NAFTA, it will not change a thing. Detroit will not suddenly boom and become a thriving metropolitan.
Appalachians are not going to suddenly start hiring back a bunch of coal miners because natural gas is less expensive.
Mm-hmm. And it really boils down to we need to think seriously about what we vote for, about what we support, about what we try to make happen, because there's several growth limiters in the United States that could stymie our growth. We could decide to follow. Japan has been – let me back up. Japan has been in a recession for over a decade.
Right.
And they got in a recession –
almost two decades.
Largely because of several major factors. There's several major factors, any one of which probably you could pull out of there and wouldn't happen. One of them is they have high restrictions on imports.
More than two decades.
Right. Well, they've been in a recession a long time. They have high restrictions on imports. They're not part of any free trade zone. And they
don't want to be.
They were willing to be part of the Trans-Pacific Partnership.
Right.
Because it gave them advantage over China. The second thing that they have in Japan that restricts it is they have a lot of infrastructure building going on to maintain full employment all the time by borrowing a lot of money. And as a result, they have one of, if not the largest, debt to GDP ratios in the world. That is in fact a serious problem. So they have trade restrictions. They have a lot of infrastructure building going on to keep everybody employed. I don't know if this sounds like anybody's policies that you've heard recently.
It sounds just like Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump's policies. They were arguing this back and forth. It was the only thing they both agreed on, except the thing that they didn't agree on was whose plan was better.
Right.
They both covered the same stuff.
And it's just not conducive to making things work. And so if you look at what the United States did during the period when we had our stock market relative to the Japanese stock market, our stock market is now 10 times higher than theirs versus 20 years ago. In other words, it used to be that there was a parity between the markets and you just add one zero to the Japanese stock market and it was the same as ours and that was simply because of the yen is approximately 100 to the dollar, roughly. Today, their stock market and our stock market is at the same level. We've erased that zero, meaning approximately the same level, meaning that our stock market
appreciated relatively
has
10 times faster.
10 times faster than theirs. What did we have they didn't have? We had NAFTA. We had free trade. We had very few restrictions in those areas.
Yep. Their innovation
and we took off and they died.
Yeah, their innovation and technology per capita is pretty close to ours. They're good at creating new types of technology. They're not good at capitalizing on it because they've made their walls around their own trade so high that it's hard to trade with anyone else profitably.
And they threw one other factor in there that we hear a lot about today, and that is restrict immigration.
Huge. They didn't restrict it. It's always been restricted. Right. They just never loosened it.
But we are – there is – if you look at the policies that got Japan into a 20-year recession – and which virtually every economist, including theirs, agree on, and you look at those policies as this, there are people in Washington who want to implement those same policies in the United States, and I'm going to tell you, there is universal agreement among anyone who studied this and reads it very carefully that we would get the same results Japan got if we did these things.
This is vital to understand. The simplest way we can say this, there's two factors that lead to growth in an economy. Two. No more. Demographics. We got to be having more babies than we have people dying.
Or have people immigrating.
Or have immigration. We have to have our population grow. If we don't have our population grow, we shouldn't expect growth in the economy. That's a pretty simple concept. People can understand that very easily. Productivity. Our productivity rate has to rise if we're going to have growth in the economy. Because the only reason why you should ever make a profit is because you're creating something of value that people are willing to pay for. The only reason why you should expect to make more profit is because you're able to make those for less money and people are still able to pay the same price for it. That's productivity growth. If you don't have your overhead costs go up, if it goes down, you can charge the same price and make a bigger profit. That's growth. That is recognizable growth. If you suddenly get a raise, and you got a raise for doing exactly the same work that you did last year, no better. That's called inflation. That's not called growth. If you got a raise because you're knocking the ball out of the park, you are doing things that other people can't do, that's productivity, and you're being compensated for it. So demographics and productivity are it. If we lower demographics, we say no more immigration, or we limit that, and we aren't having babies the way we used to. We had a minor baby boom coming out of the recession. It went away. Debt and student loans cause less babies. It's universal. Less babies means slower population growth. Productivity is the area that we have direct control over. Technology is going to help a lot there, but it requires, in a lot of cases, a lot of pain to happen before the productivity growth. You have to say the old way doesn't work so well anymore because it hurts. Or somebody else has come on the block and they have a new way of doing it and they're knocking us out of business. We got to come up with an even newer way. That's what productivity is. It isn't trying to go to the old method. If we're talking about coal mining, coal is more expensive than natural gas. We've had a big technological boom in fracking that's allowing natural gas to come out a lot cheaper than it used to be. That means that coal, unless it finds a new piece of technology that allows coal mining to be comparably efficient, comparably productive, for the same price or lower, coal mining is not going to come back. And if we throw money at it, all we're doing is teaching people who already know how to do something that's not profitable to continue to do the non-profitable thing. That's the basics of any kind of business. And I think there's no way constructively to argue that that's not the way things go. Now, in the event that somebody loses their job and needs to be retrained, whose responsibility that is? Well, first off, I would say it's the responsibility of the individual. But we as a society can't leave it that way without any training. We've taken the responsibility of educating the youth in the public system because without that education, they can't compete in business. And if they can't compete in business, then our society fails. If we treat people that have been laid off differently than we do youth that haven't been trained to work yet, then we're in a lot of trouble. So productivity and training towards productivity lies in the lap of all of us. We've got to recognize that. How we pay for it, all that good stuff, those are details that we should figure out, but they should work. The GI Bill was used to get out of the Great Depression. Now, it required someone actually earning it and putting their lives at stake in the issue. That may not be something we should require today. You got laid off, go put your life at stake, and then we'll pay for your education. That's because people die when they put their life at stake. It's probably not the best way of doing it, but we need to have some method of earning the education so that it's not free and it doesn't bog down their earning potential forever with debt. So that was my more complex than I expected to be simple explanation of why it is that trade's important, why it is that immigration is important, and why it is that the United States has been a powerhouse for as long as it is.
So since you're done with that monologue, why don't we do commercials?
Sounds good to me. If you would like to contact us and join in our dialogue, monologue, we'd make it into a trialogue for a little bit. The phone number to call in here locally is 254-773-1400, and non-locally it's still 254-773-1400. We'll be back on the other side with more of the Personal Wealth Coach.
Back with more of the Personal Wealth Coach with Jeff and
Jake
McClure. Got about 20 minutes left in the second hour today on Saturday, May 20th. And the telephone number remains 254-773-1400. So give us a call, ask us a question, make a comment about something to do with the economy or with investing or something of that nature, and stir our semi-somnolent brains into activity. Let's see. What else can we talk about here? Oh, a lot of people have been dependent upon, or at least looking forward to, tax reform. Everything we read suggests that it ain't going to happen for a while. And as a matter of fact, it may not happen at all, which is one of the reasons the market stumbled this week. And why? Well, because, very frankly, health care has to pass through the Senate, go back to the House, because the Senate is going to rewrite it.
Before taxes.
And then the Senate, the House will have to accept what the Senate wrote or not, in which case it just won't go anywhere.
Now, let me throw something in there so that people understand you didn't just change the subject. Healthcare has to pass because the version of the healthcare bill that passed cuts a lot of the federal revenue that's going towards Medicare and Medicaid. It cuts deeply into it, so it would leave it up to the states. They then would be able to use that money elsewhere and lower taxes. So that's the concept that's going forward and why healthcare has to pass first.
So healthcare has got to pass before a budget can be worked out. And the budget... Why does we have to? We've gone for 10 years without a budget. Budget resolution. We pass a budget at the last minute, kind of ad hoc, but no budget resolution. The issue about a budget resolution is if the House passes a budget resolution and the Senate signs off on the budget resolution, then bills can pass through the Senate with 51 votes. If there is no budget resolution and the budget passes without a resolution, meaning we're going to spend this money, but we've not really looked at the strategy of it. We've not really forecast out 10 years on what's going to happen if we do this, and a series of rules, then it takes 60 votes in the Senate to pass the budget. And,
well, to pass it without filibuster.
Well, basically to pass it.
Yeah. Well, yeah.
And so and there's enough Democrats to filibuster a really long time. So it really boils down to the fact that if there's no budget resolution, there can be no budget resolution unless we have health care passed. There can be no tax reform unless we have a budget resolution. And we have to have a budget, by the way, also by the end of September for the following year. Or again, no tax reform. Getting all that done was a possibility. Remember that Congress is not going to be in session full time during this period too. They're going to have recesses.
Right.
Without leadership from the president,
And right now, his leadership is being drastically reduced based on scandals, self-produced scandals.
And with the likelihood that there will be multiple investigations going on in the House and in the Senate tying up staff with regard to what happened or didn't happen or what was said or what wasn't said, the conclusion right now is not very pleasant, and that is that Congress is sufficiently diverted from the issues of the normal process of doing things like passing a budget, passing a new healthcare law, reforming taxes, all these very, very ambitious things that a lot of people thought and certainly hoped and certainly we hoped were actually going to happen, that the chances of them happening, and this is going to be blunt and maybe a little bit cold, but there's certainly people who stated this, the chances of them happening with Donald Trump as president have fallen to a very, very low number, to the point where Jeremy Siegel, who we mentioned earlier, is to us sort of a superstar because he accurately, for instance, last year he predicted that the market would be up 15% at this point. This year it's up 16%. You go down through the list of his accurate predictions over the years, they're astonishing. He's a professor. He wrote Stocks for the Long Run. And he
professor at Wharton, which I have a little bit of prejudice against, for. So
against. I heard you.
Definitely prejudice for.
But the point is that what he said is we probably will not move forward on any of these things as long as Donald Trump is president. And if he were to resign, he said this in Barron's today, the stock market would probably the Dow would jump 1,000 points almost immediately. And I think
that's true.
I think there's a lot of truth in that.
The market does not like uncertainty. That's something that I think we can all agree on very easily. The market likes to know how things are going to be going. What are taxes going to be? What's healthcare going to be like? What are profits going to be like? They like to know that. And a lot of time is put into trying to predict it. Because the more we know about that, it's kind of like a farmer getting an almanac. Well, it looks like winter begins later in the year. It's the end of the year. Winter begins. Okay, now I know when winter begins. Well, I better have my harvest done already, unless it's a winter crop. The market is like that. And by his own admission, he likes to be unpredictable. Donald Trump likes to be unpredictable. That's not good for the economy. It's not good for leadership. And when he's unpredictable in this kind of way, it's certainly not good for leadership. This is, you know, we've said it in the campaign season two, when weird shocks were hitting the system constantly. That's not good for the market. It's not good for the economy. If he stuck to his guns on a lot of the things that he said, at least we would know what to expect. That's where the issue is. It's not that he flip-flops. It's that he never says the flip or the flop without it flopping and flipping. That's the big thing. There are some very few areas where he has been adamant and hasn't budged, but I think even his supporters will have trouble listing more than two. And that's a sad thing to say, but it's a truth. You said it bluntly. Without certainty going forward, don't expect big growth in the market. Without certainty going forward, don't expect big growth in revenue, because people are going to wait and see. People in their personal lives and CEOs and CFOs in their business lives, they wait and see. Pay down the debt, keep the cash positions good. We'll see what happens. It might be a good time in the future to reinvest, but we don't know what taxes are going to be. And if they, this is a big one. A lot of things are on the table right now with tax reform. If you're buying something for your business, and that's one of the things that is removed from a deduction, then it may be better to buy it now unless they make the tax retroactive, which means it may be better not to. If you've got a choice that it may be better and it may not be better, people just tend to wait. And that's what's going on kind of across the board. And we've got a call coming in. So, caller on 773-1400. Thank you for calling, and you're on the air.
Yeah, I don't know if you guys have talked about this. It seems like a lot of the companies out there globally are sitting on, you know, mountains and mountains of cash. Is this something unique, or was there another time in the financial history where companies were hoarding cash like they do today?
Yes. Okay. Good question. Very good question.
I don't know if there's a time in
lots of times in history.
Been lots of times in history. Now, I don't know that there have been a time. The thing about, they're not just sitting on hoards of cash. They're sitting on hoards of cash outside the United States, and they're not unwilling to bring it in because it would cost them, in many cases, a quarter of the cash that they brought in would go to taxes immediately if they brought it in. For instance, if you had $1 million and you were using that $1 million to live on, and you had it in England, and then if you could continue to use it, but you could only invest in England or Europe with it, let's just say, and you're investing in Europe and you're doing okay, and that's okay. But if you brought it back to the United States and put it in a bank or in a money market fund, the federal government would charge you $250,000 to do that. You probably wouldn't be in any big rush to bring the money back to the United States, right?
And historically, to answer that directly, it's happened quite a lot in history. And what I like to do is go back a couple of hundred years, because it removes all of the political bias that we have about today. If we go back to the mid-1600s, Spain controlled the world at that point. They had huge amounts of gold. But people were trying to get the gold out of Spain as fast as they could, because the government was taxing kind of without regard to any law. They would just suddenly say, okay, this stuff belongs to the government now, and take it. And that's been a form of taxation for a long time. The French, a few decades later, did the same thing. The concept of taxation being unpredictable in a country has always led to huge amounts of cash sitting overseas. At the time that we're talking about there, a lot of cash went to the Netherlands, and it caused the Netherlands to become massively overpowered for the size of country it was. And if you think of all of the colonies that they had spreading across the world for such a tiny population, they were the powerhouse of the world for a while. Not a very long period, maybe 40 years. But 40 years is a long time if you consider your lifespan. They were the global superpower because people were afraid to have money in France or in Spain. So it left. If people are afraid to have money in the United States, which American companies are showing they do not want to bring the money back to the United States and lose a big chunk of it, then we have the really clear ability to cause some other nation to become a superpower if they just choose the right tax plan.
And if we can do a few things, and they're big things, but if we could do a few things to release that money and provide some certainty, and among other things, it would simply be make a formal declaration that we're not changing the tax code, and we are not going to cancel trade agreements.
Right.
Then a lot of that cash would get released to be reinvested, and a lot of that there's a lot of it sitting overseas. There's also a lot of it sitting in the United States that particularly small businesses are sitting on larger cash stash.
There's a concept there as well. Apple has released these really, really long-term bonds. They took a big loan out when they're sitting on this huge cash position overseas. So it's very – we mentioned Carl Icahn last hour that, you know, he gives a bunch of money to charity and then gets this loan from the charity of a bunch of money at a very low interest rate. Rather than paying taxes on the money, he gave a charitable donation, got the deduction, got a loan from the charity, and is able even to deduct the interest for the loan at the charity. What Apple's doing is it's got all this cash overseas. Anybody that looks at their book value, that's part of the value of the company. So they released this big 100-year bond, 100-year maturity bond, and people bought it like crazy. So now they have a low interest rate, long-term bond that gave them a bunch of cash here in the United States to use, but it's used knowing they have to pay it back, which causes people to be less advantageous with the money. They don't do the things that they don't take the kind of risks that lead to good innovation. If you think back to what made Apple a great company was being near bankruptcy, having a big influx of money from Bill Gates buying $100 million of non-voting shares so that the Justice Department didn't shut down Microsoft. Apple then used that money, it wasn't a loan, to increase its innovation and create new products that nobody had ever heard of before and everybody wanted immediately. If we want that kind of usage of money, we have to take the restrictions off the money. If Apple brings that money back, and say they do it right now, say they bring back $100 billion, and they've got a lot more than that, but say they bring back $100 billion that's sitting somewhere else in Ireland, and they bring it here, before they have a chance to do anything with that money, they've got to pay the tax. If you earn the money here and you reinvest that money, you can deduct that money against the taxes that you would owe. It's a direct reinvestment. They've got to do it over a long period of time. It's arbitrary in some ways, but I'm being redundant. We're talking about the tax code. As long as our corporate tax rates are high, expect more money to be held offshore, and that's where the vast majority of those cash positions are. But even more so, the cash positions that we're seeing based on uncertainty, if you look back before major political trade agreements between the royalty superpowers in the 1700s and the 1800s and the 1600s, you'll see that when a trade issue was at stake, where people didn't know if they could make trades between Britain and Spain, people sat on money. You don't want to invest money in a profitable plan to make money with partners that you don't know will be profitable because the government may change it at any moment. So some degree, and this the Republicans agree with this, by the way, by and large, they all agreed that they wouldn't pass a budget, a tax plan, or any other major bill without posting it to be read 7 days in advance. Well, they did that with the healthcare plan and then removed it and broke their own rule and basically rewrote it and said, we don't have to do that anymore. Because it's really hard to get things done politically if everybody knows what you're trying to do. It's really easy to take it apart. So we've got some conundrums. We've got some difficulties when it comes to politics and sitting on cash for companies and for personal, for the individuals out there that are sitting on cash rather than using it to do other things. It's a pretty healthy thing to have a good reserve when you don't know what the future is going to be. So if you don't know what the future is going to be in your own personal life, people tend to reserve their cash rather than spending it. Same thing's true with corporations. If someone can step forward and say, clearly, this is what we're going to do, and have it be reasonably believed based in reality of the moment, based on what they actually believe they can do, then we get some certainty. What we get from the current administration is an adamant statement of what will happen that people believed at the beginning and have come to the conclusion now that you can't trust what's being said because it may come out in a tweet later completely opposite, or it may that's why people are sitting on cash. They sat on cash during the election season because they didn't know which candidate was going to be elected, and they probably would have continued to invest if Hillary Clinton, not that Hillary Clinton would have been great for the economy, but we would have at least said, well, it's a business as usual. It's still not great, but it's business as usual. We can't even say that now. It's still not great, business as usual. Now we're saying still not great, might be worse, might be better. That leads to uncertainty.
Okay, I appreciate that. Hey, I have a follow-up question to the first caller this morning. You guys were talking about cashless society and doing away with certain denomination of bills. I guess all the bills now are Federal Reserve notes, right?
That's correct.
Yes,
that's
correct.
They used to have one, I guess, in the 40s and 50s called the Silver Certificate.
Right.
And I guess there was an old wives' tale, you know, if you took that to the bank or to the
– You actually could. Whatever, up until 1971, you could actually take it to the bank and get a silver dollar.
I was going to ask you if you had some of those laying around.
No.
You couldn't cash them in, right?
No, you couldn't get silver for them anymore. That's why we changed, because France tried to do that.
Okay. Yeah.
Well, we're about out of time. Thank you very much for the call. They were Federal Reserve notes back then, too. If you'd like to contact us off the air...
You can reach us. We have a voicemail now. We have regular call during the week at 947. It's 254-947-1111.
You can reach that toll-free at 1-800-914-7526, 1-800-914-PLAN. You can email us directly, Jeff or Jake at tpwc.com. You can go to our webpage, thepersonalwealthcoach.com. Until next week, this has been The Personal Wealth Coach.
Truth. It's not just a word on your Fox News station. News Radio 1400 KTEM AM, Temple, Belton, Killeen, Fort Hood.